Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, August 30th, 2016. I have this love-hate relationship with Apple Computer. I love the gadgets they make, and I hate that they're one of the U.S.'s biggest tax cheats. And the European Union takes my side in this dispute today, handing Apple a past-due tax bill of $14.5 billion. Let me check something here, will you? Siri, is Apple Computer a tax cheat?
Apple.com should be able to answer that question.
I'll bet. Yeah, I'll bet they have an answer for us. Well, I've been talking about this for a long time. Apple Computer has somewhere north of $180 billion in profits stashed offshore. And we don't know how much of that money was generated from sales inside the United States, but it's probably a huge chunk. And after a few years of investigation, the European Commission, under the leadership of Margrethe Vestager, the competition chief, has cracked down and sent Apple this bill for $14.5 billion. Now, they've also cracked down on Starbucks in the Netherlands, Amazon in Luxembourg, and Anheuser-Busch InBev in Belgium. And last week, we reported to you the bizarre stance of the United States government, and that is telling Europe, keep your hands off our tax thieves, okay? They're ours, not yours. And instead of saying to Apple, hey, let's work out a deal to bring some of this money home, the U.S. government appears to be supporting their sophisticated tax dodge techniques. So, and here's the quote. Last week, the Treasury Department released a report criticizing any efforts to claw back taxes from American companies. The document repeatedly claimed that the European Commission did not have the right to undertake the clawbacks. They could harm America's efforts to collect taxes from domestic companies with vast international operations. What bullshit? They make no effort to collect taxes from American-based companies with vast international operations. They do make noises when these inversions take place, where an American company merges with a foreign company and claims that it's no longer American and therefore doesn't have to pay taxes here. And we know that even companies that do pay taxes don't pay the full rate, which by statute is in the 30% range. No, they pay 15 cents on the dollar. And they want that to be even lower. So I really applaud the effort by the Europeans to try to collect this money. Apple responded, the Commission's case is not about how much Apple pays in taxes. It's about which government collects the money. Now, this is just bullshit, Siri. It is about how much. Because it's not as if, you know, Apple paid taxes in Belgium instead of Ireland. They didn't pay taxes anywhere, or at least not in any significant amounts. And maybe you heard a few years ago when it was revealed, the tax dodge technique favored by Apple and a couple of other companies, including Microsoft, is called double Irish with a Dutch sandwich. Isn't that sweet? The double Irish, I have the definition here that I looked up on the internets. And I didn't ask Siri for this. The double Irish with a Dutch sandwich is a tax avoidance technique employed by certain large corporations involving the use of a combination of Irish and Dutch subsidiary companies to shift profits to low or no tax jurisdictions. The double Irish with a Dutch sandwich technique involves sending profits first through one Irish company, then to a Dutch company, and finally to a second Irish company headquartered in a tax haven. This technique has allowed certain corporations to reduce their overall corporate tax rates dramatically, if not to zed. And so this is what is being called out. And the Irish Parliament tightened up their rules, and the double Irish with a Dutch sandwich is no longer available to new corporate applicants, but they've grandfathered it in for another 3 or 4 years. Now, Apple says they're confident it will be overturned and that it may take several years. They're prepared to lawyer this up for, and of course, with that much money on the line, you can spend a lot on lawyers and still come out of it ahead. And here's what's interesting, the politics of it. Donald Trump has broken with some conservative orthodoxy by saying that he would force American companies like Apple to move manufacturing jobs inside the country, rather than allowing them to seek cheaper labor overseas. And he said that he would lower the U.S. corporate tax rate in an effort to lure companies to act like Americans. And Hillary Clinton, who just attended a fundraiser hosted by Apple CEO Tim Cook last week, well, she has also hinted that she might lower the corporate tax rate, said she would move to stop U.S. firms from using the inversion plan to avoid American taxes. But given her corporate history, we can't really expect Hillary to take this on in a serious way. And Democrats, led by outgoing Senator Barbara Boxer from here in California, have carried water for Silicon Valley companies, looking for ways, for example, to give them a tax break on money they bring back into the country and then use that to rebuild our infrastructure. I don't support that. I think these companies should stop skating, should stop cheating, and should pay their damn taxes, just like you and I have to. Also from Europe, France's trade minister has increased the pressure on the U.S.-EU trade deal called the TTIP and is saying that the calls should be suspended. And this has been embraced by the French president, François Hollande, who said that France would not support a deal this year. This is on the heels of a statement that came from Germany's economy minister, Sigmar Gabriel, who said on Sunday, the negotiations with the United States have de facto failed, although nobody is really admitting it. And this news breaks, as we heard a few days ago, that the Republicans' chief obstructionist and majority leader of the United States Senate, Mitch McConnell, has said that he will not permit a vote on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, during the lame duck session and up through the end of this year. Now, McConnell can only speak that far because the Senate composition could change. He could lose his post as majority leader with the incoming Senate in January, and so he can only speak to the window where he clearly will retain his authority. And while I generally don't support obstruction, and I certainly don't obstruct, I don't support McConnell's obstruction of Obama's Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland, who I think is a lightweight, but still the president has his prerogative. This is one set of obstruction, one type of obstruction that I do support, and Bernie Sanders spoke up last week in support of the decision by Mitch McConnell, and so we'll see if that holds. Recently, we learned that the federal government is going to stop using corporate prisons for criminal inmates. And now, because of pressure and some howling that came from people like me and people like me, but who have more influence, we are hearing that at least the Department of Homeland Security under Jay Johnson is going through the motions of reconsidering whether it's going to continue to use corporate or private prisons. And if so, it will take a while because they just sealed a four-year billion-dollar deal with the Corrections Corporation of America. And I explained how that was done through a sneaky deal that used the contract for a CCA prison in Eloy, Arizona, to launder the money through for a facility in Texas that CCA has gotten a sweetheart guaranteed payment from the federal government. No matter how many people are housed there every night, they get paid for a full house. Isn't that a sweet deal? So currently about 25,000 immigrant prisoners are locked up in corporate prisons across the country. And Jay Johnson says that they're going to review this, but it really doesn't make a lot of sense other than a press release designed to distract us from the fact that, you know, these corporate prisons are going to be in the picture for at least the foreseeable future. And so I think that while I like seeing this press release, I don't expect much to happen. And we are stuck with the conundrum of these privatized prison operations in this country. And it's interesting because here in California, we're sending a really mixed message. Last week, our legislature passed a bill that would ban the use of private immigration detention centers in the state of California. Now, you might, you know, initially think, well, California's a state. The federal government handles immigration prisoners. So how is this going to have any impact? Well, it turns out that the state of California, through the county operations, does hold a number of immigrant prisoners on a regular basis. It's a small number, about 3,700. They are detained by the federal government, but they're held in private prisons under contracts with four California cities: Bakersfield, San Diego, Adelanto in San Bernardino County, and Calexico in Imperial County. And so this is going to be phased out. The irony is that the state will continue to hold criminal prisoners who are residents of the state of California and citizens of the United States in corporate prisons for at least the foreseeable future. We have about 6,000 held in private prisons inside California, and another 4,800 are held in private prisons out of state. Almost 3,000 are at the CCA facility I mentioned in Eloy, Arizona. And the rest are in Tutwiler, Mississippi. Now, California was forced to make these moves because the federal courts have put the state under orders to reduce the prison population due to massive overcrowding. And so Governor Brown, who didn't want to release about 11,000 of these people, instead has stashed them in private prisons. And until the state prison population can be further reduced, it appears that California will continue to contract with corporate minders of prison institutions. Yesterday, I saw a story and I held it until today. And then last night, I watched my regular round of television news and I found a lot of coverage of a man named Jesse Morton. And Jesse Morton once was a young Muslim convert, a fiery voice who supported Al-Qaeda and who recruited Americans off the streets of New York. And he ended up going to prison a couple of times, once for selling drugs and later for other issues. And in prison, he appeared to have a real catharsis. That is where he first found Islam. And then, while he was in prison a second time, he decided to become an FBI informant because FBI agents came and told him that some of his recruits had done some pretty dastardly deeds. And there's no suspense to this story. The reason that Jesse Morton is being profiled in such a prominent way is that he started a job recently at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. And similar to hiring a former bank robber to help you provide better security in banks, the idea is that if we have former jihadis and terrorist sympathizers help study these issues and try to prevent others from being radicalized, that this could have some impact. And let me say at the outset here that I'm dubious. I'm skeptical about this guy Morton. And part of it is because he did become an FBI informant. And he got 8 years off in prison as a result of his collaboration with law enforcement. And so it's possible that he has risen above this and that he has sufficient intellectual and personal integrity to operate without being, you know, an asset of our government. But based on the story that is being reported, I have concerns about that, and so we'll keep an eye on Jesse Morton and just see what surfaces over the next year or two. Meanwhile, from the Middle East, and this is an interesting report, because often we get claims from the Pentagon that they have killed the number two leader of Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State or the Taliban, and then we have to add again. Because often the reports that come after a drone strike or some other American operation are inconclusive, and the people we claim to have snuffed pop up and say, "Hi, I'm still alive." So this report actually comes from the Islamic State itself, and they are saying that one of their top dogs, whose name is Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, was killed in the Syrian province of Aleppo, and the report came out on Tuesday, today, our time. And he is described as the chief propagandist, and that he was behind the Islamic State's call for attacks against Western interests around the world. He was also widely believed to be an operational leader, running what the group called its external operations division. So this is interesting news. Will it change the course of events in the complex and convoluted war in Syria? I doubt it, but it's worth reporting. Meanwhile, in Yemen, the Saudi offensives continue there, and there's also internal conflict that continues. A suicide car bombing claimed by the Islamic State in the southern port city of Aden on Monday killed at least 54 pro-government recruits, and another 70 individuals were wounded in this attack. And this, of course, is this ongoing conflict that is fueled by Saudi Arabia and, of course, the ever-changing leader of a former leader and would-be future leader of Yemen, who has changed his alliances. And it's going to be, I think, a long slog there. And the U.S. really makes no effort to rein in the Saudis, who rain devastation from the skies on a daily basis. Off the coast of Libya, more than 3,000 migrants were rescued from these large wooden boats that are overcrowded and leaky. And the flow of migrants continues, almost unabated. And these are people who can no longer exit, say, from Turkey to Greece and get to Europe that way. Most of these appear to be Africans in origin. And it is just a you know, further messy situation because of the failed state in Libya and the continued gyrations of the Islamic State. Now, we've been told that the Islamic State was pretty well wiped out in the city of Sirte along the Libyan coastline. But over the weekend, at least 38 Libyan forces were killed as the IS dispatched a dozen suicide bombers to stop the push to drive the so-called terrorists out of their last major bastion in the country. And we're hearing new predictions that they're, you know, that they will be wiped out and eliminated from the scene there forthwith. But then we've heard that before. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Keith Hull, Pauline Nixon, and somebody from Fry Consulting dropped by and checked it out with the 24-hour pass. Good going. Come on back and take out a real subscription, okay? If you're not currently a subscriber, just head on over to peterbcollins.com. You click the menu button, it pulls down. Click on Become a Subscriber. That takes you to the sign-up page. And in just a couple of minutes, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or $50 annual subscription. Don't forget the Apple App Store features the Peter B. Collins app. I think it's $2.99, and it really works great on your iPhone. Just ask Siri. She'll tell you. And I do appreciate all the people who support my work here. Interesting story in the New York Times today, and the byline is Isabel Kirshner in Israel. And it describes the process of how unauthorized, illegal settlements on Palestinian land dot the hilltops in the West Bank, and that over time, these settlements become regularized, normalized, and retroactively legalized. And this is theft of property, pure and simple. But because the Israelis claim that it is their destiny, and their sense of entitlement runs unchecked by the international community for the most part, this is a serious problem where they simply keep creeping and taking over more territory from Palestinians who are defenseless. And this, of course, is at the core of the stalled efforts to broker some peace between Israel and the Palestinians. The U.S. has given up. Just about everybody else has given up. And so Benjamin Netanyahu and his extreme government in Israel just continue this quiet expansion and annexation of property. And I'm glad that the Times is reporting it, because this is one of those events that happens over a period of time, and there's no sharp news hook here, you know, that something crucial happened, or they broke through, or there's a violent reaction. And so I do appreciate that the Times is covering it. But we have a government that is really... It is subservient to the interests of the state of Israel to a degree that continues to shock me. Now that I've said something nice about the New York Times, let me go in the other direction. Today they published an editorial called Cutting Ties to the Clinton Foundation. And it is really a milquetoast approach. It begins by asking and answering a question. Does the new batch of State Department emails prove that big money donors got special favors from Mrs. Clinton while she was Secretary of State? They answer their own question, not so far. But that's not true. If you want to just single out the case of the Crown Prince of Bahrain, for whom the path was greased by Doug Band at the Clinton Foundation contacting Huma Abedin at the State Department, trying to get on Hillary's schedule. And after that meeting, U.S. support to suppress the Arab Spring in Bahrain increased massively. So to say that there is no quid pro quo, there's no pay to play, there's no connection between access to the foundation and access to the State Department, that's simply not true. And I am stunned by the amount of spinning that's going on these days. And I mentioned the dinner party I attended over the weekend, where one individual suggested or basically demanded that somebody like me go silent and not criticize Hillary Clinton until after the election. And that seems to be the attitude of so much of the corporate media. Oh, well, Hillary sucks, but she's better than Trump, and so we're going to go easy on her. Well, I'm not going to do that. And I'm not going to offer, you know, fuzzy thinking or kind of recharacterize, you know, the criticisms of the Clinton Foundation for political reasons. I just don't operate that way. And if that offends you, I understand. And you can take your earbuds somewhere else. So the editorial goes on to suggest that the foundation should immediately ban contributions from foreign and corporate entities. But in just 2 weeks or so, the Clinton Global Initiative will be meeting in its annual festivities in New York that are timed around the UN General Assembly. And they're going to do one more round of grabbing contributions from foreign and corporate sources. And they're saying they'll clean it up if she gets elected. Well, a conflict of interest is the same now as it would be in November. And the idea that you can collect this money and months later Hillary Clinton moves to the White House and doesn't do favors for the people who helped the foundation, that just doesn't pass a fundamental test, a smell test. Dozens of civil rights, criminal justice, and open government organizations have urged Attorney General Loretta Lynch to withhold federal funding from local police departments until they report comprehensive data on people killed by their officers. And this is not just some idle demand, because a law from 2014 allows the Attorney General to impose reductions of 10% on the funding given by the Justice Department to police chiefs under a federal grant program if their departments don't report deaths in custody. So I think this is an excellent move. It is well within the law. And we really need to turn this around, because we have a couple of newspapers, including one from London, The Guardian, that do a better job of collecting this data than our own government does. And The head of the leadership conference on civil and human rights, whose name is Wade Henderson, he said, you know, it's the government that should be providing journalists with transparent data, not the other way around. And I think that's very well said. I found two interesting articles at Reason Magazine's website. Reason is a libertarian-oriented publication. And I'm linking to both of these articles. I think they deserve your study. One relates to an episode from 2015. The FBI cracked into the Tor security system, and they were able to access a child pornography bulletin board operating on the dark web called the Playpen. And instead of shutting it down when they arrested the people who were running it, they continued to operate it for a two-week period. They made upgrades to the servers and the operation so that you could download the child pornography faster, and they increased the traffic at the site by remarkable numbers. Now, there are a couple of issues in play here, as there are now 186 or more cases that have surfaced from what's called Operation Pacifier. And the tactics of the FBI, where they continued to operate a criminal enterprise in order to entrap suspects, is causing judges to throw these cases out. And the other issue of concern is the credibility of the Tor browser. And it's interesting, in my recent in-depth interview with Bill Binney and Kirk Wiebe, the NSA veterans, I asked Binney about Tor. And he said, oh, I think it works. I think it's, a credible system. But it's clear that the FBI does know how to hack it. And so if you're accessing porn or buying drugs or ordering up a hit or whatever dark web activities you think are kept private by Tor, well, you should reconsider that. So while the FBI was operating this website called the Playpen, traffic increased fivefold to 50,000 people a week. And this raises important questions. At what point does the FBI become criminal itself in operating a criminal enterprise in order to attract criminals and crack down on them? How much does the end justify the means in this case? One of the issues used to throw out some of the charges that have come up under this sting operation is an arcane matter that is currently in the process of being changed. Up until recently, federal court regulations required that a warrant issued in a case like this only applied in the immediate geographic area where the alleged crimes were occurring. And now the government has quietly moved, saying, well, with the internet, these crimes can occur anywhere. And so they're saying that the FBI can get a single warrant that is good in any jurisdiction throughout the United States. And so we now see that it was this Operation Pacifier that led the FBI to quietly move to change those rules of criminal procedure. And I don't support that. The other article that came from Reason Magazine also echoes what Bill Binney and Kirk Wiebe told us, that the shadow broker's leak of NSA hacking tools shows, number one, that the NSA prioritizes surveillance over security, because all of this relates to what are called zero-day vulnerabilities. 0 day is the first day that software is released, and that's when hackers go to work on it to see what the vulnerabilities are. And when the NSA discovers those vulnerabilities, they should be notifying the software manufacturer or developer so that those vulnerabilities can be fixed. But if you do that, the NSA can't get in for surveillance. And so the NSA, and this is an argument that Binney and Wiebe have been making for years, the NSA intentionally maintains low levels of security in order to enhance the ease of their surveillance access. And in this article written by Andrea Castillo, quote, "Whoever they are, shadow brokers' actions have provided some long overdue transparency for NSA hacking methods. The leak confirms what many have suspected for decades. The NSA opportunistically hoards and deploys powerful bugs that make everyone less secure online." And the other issue relates to what we discussed with Binny and Wiebe. And by the way, that interview is now released. It's unrestricted, so if you don't have a subscription, you can grab it and listen to it. And what they have argued is that the twin roles of the NSA today, where the Cyber Command conducts offensive cyber warfare operations and the NSA does monitoring and security operations, that's a conflict of interest within the agency itself. And yet, nobody is really attempting to address that. And once again, our security, our privacy are severely compromised, and our Fourth Amendment rights are just about optional now. Here in California, where the legislature is in the final few hours of its session, they are wrangling over a bill that was in response to the attacks on Planned Parenthood using the secretly recorded and selectively edited videos that came from a group that called itself the Center for Medical Progress, and David DeLeiden was the anti-abortion activist who produced those videos. So, Planned Parenthood asked for a tightening up of the law, and Jimmy Gomez, an assembly member from Los Angeles, wrote a bill that would make the penalties similar for laws that already exist, making unauthorized recordings of a conversation in California illegal. But over at the ACLU, they're concerned that the measure is written too broadly and could inadvertently catch people in criminal activity. Now, one example is that the author of the bill, Jimmy Gomez, recently was playing softball and he cracked his elbow. He wound up in the hospital, and while he was there, they did a Facebook Live feed from the hospital. And someone raised the point that this could violate the law that Gomez has written. The ACLU legislative director, Kevin Baker, said, "You might be inadvertently recording conversations and posting them online in ways that violate the wording of this law." And also, We should note that DeLeiden claimed that he was conducting investigative journalism when he shot these secret videos, and that is an important aspect that we don't want to compromise. We want real journalists to be able to shoot secret video. And finally today, yesterday I expressed my embarrassment that the California legislature had not come to terms with a new overtime expansion law for farm workers here in California, because existing law only allowed overtime wages to kick in after 10 hours a day or 60 hours in a week. And the new regulations, which will kick in over a four-year period gradually, will require overtime pay of time and a half at 8 hours a day or 40 hours a week, and double time if you work more than 12 hours a day. This brings farm workers up to parity with the rest of the workforce in California. It is long overdue, and we don't know exactly what Governor Brown will do with this bill. He's very unpredictable when it comes to the tension between farm workers and agribusiness. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast today. You're free to share this far and wide. I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.